The next case this morning is 5-23-12-16, People versus Waring. Arguing for the appellant is Angela Rainey. Arguing for the appellee is Louis Hizzo. Each side will have 10 minutes for their argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Each, please note, only the clerk of the court is permitted to record these proceedings today.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor.
So, I'm just getting my notes here squared away. Miss Rainey, you ready to proceed?
I am ready.
Then go right ahead.
May it
And
please
welcome
the
to
court.
the Fifth District, I might add.
Thank you so much. This is my first state appeal. I appreciate it. May it please the court. My name is Angela Rainey. I'm here on behalf of appellant Paul Waring. And briefly, this court involves an altercation between Mr. Waring and Mr. Johnson, who at the time was the mayor of a very small town of Mounds, Illinois. As a result, Mr. Waring was convicted of aggravated assault of a municipal employee, aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, and aggravated assault on public property. We're asking that the court reverse all three of these convictions on the basis of insufficient evidence. And first, I would argue that there was insufficient evidence that Johnson had a reasonable apprehension of a battery. And briefly, there were a couple of incidents that this assault was based on that are relevant here. The first, Johnson alleged that Waring crossed the street yelling threats and then lunged or attempted to lunge at him over a tractor and bush hog while two men were holding him back. Importantly here, it is an objective inquiry for the court, but the court can consider information that the victim knew about the aggressor. And here it's important to note that Johnson testified that he was not afraid during any point of this event. He, inconsistent with his actions, he made no attempt to flee. There was evidence that his car was nearby. He made no attempt to get to his car and get away. In fact, he stayed at the scene and called the police. Now, after he testified that he was not afraid, it was only in response to the prosecutor's leading question that he acknowledged he had some fear, but it was not during this initial incident where he crossed the street. It was during this incident where he was holding a machete across the road. He never said he was afraid while there was this lunging incident. And I would note that under Illinois law, neither of these incidents qualify, even when the evidence taken, in the light most favorable to the state, neither of these incidents qualify as an assault. So in this lunging incident, the mayor testified that there was a barrier between the two. He said there was 8 feet, there was a tractor and a bush hog between the two, and there were two men holding on to Mr. Waring. And it is important to note that he was familiar with Mr. Waring from city council meetings. Mr. Waring was older and had some significant injuries that would have made this impossible for him. Now, in the machete incident, Johnson testified that Waring was just holding the machete. He admitted that Waring made no threatening gestures or threats while he was holding the machete. He simply got the machete off his tractor and held it. Now, although the state's brief indicates that Waring approached with the machete, that's not the evidence in the record here. Johnson's testimony was clearly that Waring just held the machete. I would argue too that the judge's findings in this bench trial were, I guess, against the manifest weight of the evidence. The judge found it relevant that Waring had a request for paramedics, but the record indicates that he did not request the paramedics. He just complained about some shoulder pain that he had. And Mr. Waring does have significant shoulder injuries. He's had some surgeries and different things like that. And he had been handcuffed, so that's reasonable. The judge found it relevant that the defendant left the scene, but that would, show some kind of indication that he had a guilty mind. But that's not the case here. He did leave the scene. He told the officers that he left the scene so he could take this machete and sharpen it. And when the officers were there, he was coming back. So this is not a case where he was trying to flee or hide evidence. He actually had the machete in the car with him whenever he came back. I would go to my next argument, which it has to do with count three, the aggravated assault of a deadly weapon argument. There was no evidence in the record that this was a deadly weapon. Indeed, the prosecutor introduced no evidence and made no argument to that effect.
Let me stop you there, counsel. Wasn't the machete itself introduced into evidence?
The machete itself was introduced into evidence. That's correct. But the unrebutted testimony here is that that machete was rusty. The officers and the victim testify to that. The unrebutted testimony from Waring and Webb, the other defense witness, was that this machete was so flimsy that it was about to fall off the handle. And at trial, this machete was not sharp. At trial, the defense attorney actually ran his hand over the blade to demonstrate that this machete was not sharp. So there's no indication. It doesn't sound like this would make a very good bludgeon if it was about to fall off the handle. And if it was not sharp, it was not going to cause injury to that
Case law
end.
that says that a weapon like that has to be sharp to not be a deadly weapon?
It's not that it doesn't have to be sharp because it certainly can be used as a bludgeon. The case law says that the court has to consider the characteristics of the weapon. And here, the characteristics of the weapon are that it could not be used as a knife as it was not sharp. The defense attorney ran his hand over the blade, so it clearly couldn't cause injury to that effect. And there was no evidence that it could be used as a bludgeon. In fact, the only testimony that was unrebutted by the state that this thing was so flimsy it was about to fall off the handle.
There are also photos that were introduced of the machete as well, correct?
Correct. There was photos and the machete was
It looks
introduced.
like they were taken on the back of a car, actually, the photos. Would that be accurate?
I do not recall that, but I do recall that there was a photo of that machete.
And that photo, it appears to me that it's sitting on the back of a car and that it took up about the half the size of the trunk of a sedan type of car. Would that be an accurate statement?
And I'm sorry, I don't recall that photo. It has been quite a while since I viewed
Okay.
it.
All right. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. I mean, like I said, there's unrebutted testimony in this record that even if it did take up half of this trunk of this car, that it was about to fall off the handle. And it is the law that the court does need to look at the characteristics of this weapon. So, and even where something is a large weapon, it still has to be capable of causing a deadly injury.
I'm going to ask
And
you a couple questions, kind of piggybacking from Justice Scholler about your issue about the length of the blade.
yes.
The machete itself, as you indicated, was introduced in the evidence. The trier of fact has the ability to look at that machete and can tell that's bigger than 3 inches to take it into a category two. And then the state, basically says the argument's been waived, and I know, and I'm looking at your reply brief. You kind of hit that, but I'm curious as to why we shouldn't find that's waived when, this was all in the trial court. There was really no objection. If there's no objection, the state is unable then to, cure a problem that should have been cured in the trial court.
Sure, I would be happy to respond to that. I would think as to that argument that it was waived, this is a sufficiency of the evidence claim, so that cannot be waived in the trial court. Is a response I would give to that. Now that I know the court or the state does cite to a case, but that was a very different set of facts. It had to do with whether a gun was a sawed-off shotgun. There was actually testimony from an officer that the gun was a sawed-off shotgun. Here, there was no testimony. And there is case law that I cited in my brief that says it's not the judge's duty to make this determination for the prosecution, where the prosecution introduces no evidence to that effect. There was a case that actually involved a knife where the judge looked at the knife and said, this blade, found the length of the blade, and the appellate court reversed, finding that it's not the judge's job to do this, where the state offered no testimony. And I would note here, it would have been very easy for the state to do this. The courts have said, normally this comes in through testimony of someone that measured the blade. So all the state had to do was have the officer measure the blade and say it was over 3 inches. That wasn't done here. That certainly was not done here. And that touches on my argument on that that over 3 inches argument. I think that the next argument that I would address is there's no evidence that Mr. Waring knew that the mayor was or performing official duties. So Johnson, the former mayor, testified that working on this equipment, he was maintaining a bush hog and a tractor. He testified that this was not his official duty. He noted that it was the maintenance supervisor's duty to do this. He had fired the maintenance supervisor and he was voluntarily going to the garage and doing this. And not only that, there was just no evidence introduced that Waring knew this. And the state does have the burden of producing evidence that Waring actually knew he was performing an official duty.
Rainey, though, Mr. Johnson was a former councilman himself, though, correct?
Yes, Waring was a former council member. But
And he
you know,
knew that the mayor was the mayor, obviously, and that that
correct.
was Public Works facility, correct?
There's no evidence that he knew this was a garage. Maybe he did. I don't know that, but there's no evidence in the record that he knew this was a garage. I would assume, if the state had introduced evidence that this building was marked as a city garage, that you could use that as evidence, but there's no evidence even to that effect. There's no evidence that Waring knew this was a city tractor or a city bush hog. So absent that kind of evidence, which it's just completely absent any circumstantial evidence in that regard. It would just be speculation. And I would think the reasonable person, if they saw a mayor working on a bush hog, they would not think that was the mayor's official duties. And in Mounds, this is not a time, a town where the mayor has a set hours. He testified he only made $325 a month doing this job. So it's not like, oh, I saw the mayor during the day. He was definitely working. There's nothing in the record to support this idea that he knew that the mayor was a performing official duties. And I see that my time is up, Your Honor.
Go right ahead and finish your thought.
And that was, the state does argue that the defendant was well aware that Johnson was working on city equipment, but it cites to no evidence to support that. And I am very familiar with this record, the transcript, and there's just no evidence in there to support that. And we would ask that the court reverse all three of these convictions based on the insufficiency of the evidence.
Well, thank you, counsel. And obviously, you're going to have your rebuttal time. But before we move on, Justice Vaughn or Justice Scholar, do you have any questions?
Not at this time.
Do you agree that the standard of review is considering the evidence in the light most favorable to the state?
I do agree that that is in the light most favorable of the state. And as I've recited the facts today, I believe I've recited them in the light most favorable to the state. There certainly was conflicting testimony, but I'm taking the what Mr. Johnson, the former mayor, said.
Do you think there's a difference in saying I was not afraid and I was thought I was about to receive an imminent battery?
If I think the reasonable person, if they thought they were about to be battered, would be afraid. I certainly think that. I suppose maybe there could be a difference, but in this case, Mr. Johnson's actions supported the fact that he was not afraid. The evidence showed that he had a car nearby and he'd made no attempt to flee. There's was no testimony that he even stepped back or did anything like that. And when he does say he feared a battery, it's important to note that whenever he's asked that follow-up leading question, he doesn't say he feared a battery whenever Mr. Waring was lunging at him. He just goes to, well, when he was holding that machete, I thought he was coming for me. But when he was holding that machete, he was all the way across a highway. And Mr. Waring testified, or Mr. Johnson testified that, he just held it. And there was a reasonable explanation for that. They were at the church cutting, doing lawn work. They had a machete to do that. They had a lawnmower. So there's
That kind of
reasonable
brings up the
explanation.
question of the machete, though. If you've got a machete to cut down sprouts or cut down weeds or cut something down, then how it may not be a sharp machete, but it apparently will slice through weeds or sprouts or whatever you need a machete for. So.
Well, that was part of the problem is they weren't able to use it. Waring testified, and it was not rebutted that the guy that was working with him brought this machete. It was in pitiful condition. They couldn't even use it. In fact, he was going to go try and sharpen it. That's why he got on the tractor and went back to his house, was to try to sharpen it. And then he testifies that even whenever I sharpened this rusty old machete, it was not sharp. And indeed, I mean, the prosecutor was able to run his hand over the blade during the bench trial.
There was some dispute about whether or not he actually picked up the machete or knocked it off the tractor and picked it up
Yeah,
three times.
Yeah, there was disputed testimony over that. Mr. Waring said he was getting on the tractor and he kicked the machete. That's why he picked it up. Mr. Johnson testified that he got the machete and held it. But even under Mr. Johnson's version of events, he only held it, and the law is pretty clear that just holding a weapon is not enough. There has to be some kind of threatening words with that, or some kind of gesture. Mr. Johnson testified that he just held it. He testified that Waring didn't say anything. Waring didn't wave the machete or make any kind of threatening gesture. So I think under the law, that cannot qualify as an assault. I can't or cannot be a reasonable apprehension of a battery.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything else, justices?
No.
All right. Again, like I said, you'll have your opportunity for your rebuttal. Mr. Hizzo, go right ahead.
Thank you. Chief Justice, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Louis Hizzo, and I represent the state on the matter. This court should affirm the defendant's convictions for aggravated assault and hold that the elements were proven beyond a reasonable doubt for each respective counts for four reasons. First, the defendant's actions did place Mr. Johnson in a reasonable apprehension of a battery. Second, the trial court found the machete to be a deadly weapon. Third, the state proved that the machete was a Category 2 weapon as defined under Section 33A-1C2 of the Criminal Code. And lastly, the state proved the defendant committed the aggravated assault on a municipal employee while he also knew Mr. Johnson was performing his official duties. The state would rest on its brief in regards to any arguments that I don't have an opportunity to address this morning. But as an initial point of contention, this court should affirm the defendant's convictions for aggravated battery because the state did prove Mr. Johnson's apprehension of an imminent battery was reasonable. To this end, to sustain a charge of aggravated assault, as this court is well aware, the state has to prove that defendant without lawful authority engaged in conduct that placed another in a reasonable apprehension of receiving that battery. Whether that victim is placed in a reasonable apprehension of a battery is a question that is reviewed. Excuse me, is a question that the fact finder must determine based on the facts before the court. Here, in assessing that reasonable apprehension of the battery, the victim does not need to testify expressly that he was in such apprehension or that he was afraid. Rather, that can be easily, reasonably inferred by the evidence presented at trial. And it is true, yes, words alone are not enough, and some action or condition must then follow those words. So, in reviewing the facts in the light most favorable to the state, the evidence presented here was more than enough to convict the defendant and allow the trial court to find the element of reasonable apprehension because, as highlighted in our brief, context to this altercation is important to the analysis. For example, at trial, Mr. Johnson testified that while he was working on the equipment, he noticed that the defendant was driving his tractor across the street at the defendant's church. At some point, the defendant then gets off his tractor, crosses the street towards Mr. Johnson. The defendant began yelling words at Mr. Johnson in rage and stated something to the effect of, "Congratulations for ruining my grandson's life." The defendant then proceeds to cross the road and engage with Mr. Johnson. The defendant's grandson and another individual then had to intervene and get in between defendant and Mr. Johnson. The evidence presented further established that the two individuals were able to initially stop the defendant from getting to the Mr. Johnson, but ultimately the defendant was able to push them off initially as he lunged towards Mr. Johnson. And both men were then they had to intervene a second time to prevent the defendant from getting closer. Mr. Johnson recalled that the defendant yelled at him numerous times and said statements to the effect of the word was out on him. And while it is true that the testimony reflects that there was about 8 feet in between the defendant and Mr. Johnson, I would again fall under the premise that the apprehension analysis requires an objective standard analysis, and it isn't it would be important to this analysis to also factor in the fact that Mr. Johnson testified that all defendant had to do was cross that bush hog that remained between the two of them. The defendant had broken that initial restraint that prevented him from getting to the defendant before lunging a second time towards him. And when considering that defendant had already crossed the street in rage to get to Mr. Johnson, and more importantly, the defendant needed to be restrained twice, it was not so improbable for the court to find the defendant's actions did place Mr. Johnson in a reasonable apprehension of receiving a battery. And again, the relevant question here requires the evidence to be reviewed in the light most favorable to the state. And as a final note to the specific issue, I would also note that the trial court considered the context of what caused the defendant's rage to begin with. To that end, the court was made aware that there was a previous incident involving Mr. Johnson and defendant's grandson, in which the defendant's grandson had been arrested for breaking into Mr. Johnson's vehicle. This factor was also given weight and consideration by the trial court when analyzing whether that reasonable apprehension of receiving a battery was present, because it shed light to the amount of anger that the defendant was having at the time. This court should hold, given that reason, the defendant's rage in conjunction with the actions of not only crossing the road, but lunging at Mr. Johnson twice, that it was not so unreasonable or improbable for the court to find that the defendant's actions did place Mr. Johnson in a reasonable apprehension. I would ask this court to affirm that the lower court's ruling as regards to that element, as the state was able to present and prove that beyond a reasonable doubt.
Can you address the issue of the status of the machete as a deadly weapon?
Yes, Your Honor. As it re regards to the deadly weapon status, the aggravated assault statute states in pertinent part that a person commits the offense of aggravated assault when that person uses a deadly weapon, as this court's well aware. And it is further defined under our case law, Stanley, that a deadly weapon is one that is dangerous to life or one likely to produce death or great bodily harm or injury. That same case also states that some cases are deadly per se. So, it is our position, much as it was in Stanley, that weapons such as guns, pistols, dirk knives, and even small pocket knives are considered deadly weapons per se, or can become deadly weapons depending on the circumstances. That in this situation, it was not so improbable for the court to determine that, this was a deadly weapon per se, given the nature of the actual object used. Again, we would fall rest on the fact that a machete is commonly used to cut larger items, and the nature of it, as a long-bladed knife, would further, show that it is per se a deadly weapon. Although the defendant argues that there was evidence introduced at trial contesting the condition of the machete, the state would rest on the standard of review, which is especially important here, considering that the machete was actually introduced at trial for the court's explicit review of the object. And the court noted its review of the weapon during its deliberation. The court had an opportunity to analyze and determine the potential harm, and evaluate that machete against the testimony that was actually presented during the defendant's case in chief, that suggested that there was, rust, or whether the machete itself was flimsy. The defendant also argues that there was no evidence presented that he used or threatened to use the machete in any way that could cause death or serious injury. However, it is important to again note that the defendant didn't just, although he claims at trial that it fell or stumbled out of his tractor, it's important to note that, in reviewing the evidence in light most favorable to the state, he obtained this machete after lunging towards Mr. Johnson twice. And the threats that were made in conjunction with those actions, further supports that the defendant at one point, was, excuse me, at one point, the object was used in furtherance of this aggravated assault. It is true, it's unclear which way the machete was held up, so that, there is evidence that is contradicted. However, I would again ask the court to view that in the light most favorable to the state. It cannot be overlooked that a defendant went out of his way to obtain this machete amidst, the assault Given the nature of the weapon and the trial court's ability to actually evaluate it, we ask this court to affirm the lower court's ruling, finding that weapon deadly, as defined under the aggravated assault statute. I would briefly note that there was also the issue of whether or not the defendant waived the Category 2 definition at trial. The state maintains that, this issue was actually waived, and the trial court specifically noted the waiver during its deliberation when it stated that, excuse me here, it had an opportunity to inspect and rationally determine the blade and the machete was longer than 3 inches. It also noted that neither attorney addressed the size of the blade. Again, that would support the issue or our notion of waiver at this point with regards to that issue. And Your Honors, I see that my time is up, so I would ask this court to affirm all convictions.
Justice Vaughn or Justice Scholar, do you have any questions for Mr. Hizzo?
I have no questions. Thank you.
No, I have no further.
All right. Well, thank you, counsel. Ms. Rainey, go right ahead with your rebuttal.
Still muted.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah, I would briefly address these the argument by the state. It is important that the defendant testified that he was not afraid. Now, it's true that the case law says that the defendant doesn't have to testify to fear, but the case cited by the government was very, very different. In this case, Mr. Johnson affirmatively said that he was not afraid, and his actions supported that.
Does it make a
And
difference that two people thought there was going to be a battery and so they're holding him back? And doesn't that seem to indicate somebody thought something was about to happen?
so in response to that, I would say that this court's case in State versus Van Hoos supports the argument that any reason that or an apprehension of a battery was not reasonable there. So in Van Hoos, the court found that in the light most favorable to the state, the defendant was flying up a hill on a motorcycle yelling threats. But the court noted that there was a bat or there was a barrier in between the two. And so in light of that, the court found that the apprehension was not reasonable. And here I would note there or the victim testified there were it was 8 feet. There was a tractor and bush hog in between the two. His contention that Mr. Waring was going to lunge over that was just not reasonable. He knew Mr. Waring. Mr. Waring had significant mobility limitations. And even if he didn't know that, it's unreasonable to think someone could lunge over a bush hog. The other thing is, while there the testimony showed two people holding back, that actually constitutes another barrier. Although there were two lunging incidents testified to by Johnson, both times the guys were holding him back. So I would say these barriers under Van Hoos, these barriers would indicate that any apprehension of a battery is not reasonable in this situation. And I would go to what the government is saying about the deadly weapon finding that the judge found that this was a deadly weapon, but it's not clear that the standard was understood. The prosecutor didn't argue the appropriate standard and introduced no evidence to that effect. And notably, when the judge found Mr. Waring guilty on this count, he said that the standard was similar to the account for aggravated assault of a municipal employee. And that's clearly not the case. In that count, the judge had to find a Category 2 weapon, and he made no finding specifically that that's a deadly weapon. So it's not clear that that standard was understood. And I would note that under the Supreme Court case of Ross, even a gun has to be shown that it's a deadly weapon. If the gun is not loaded, the courts have found that it's not a deadly weapon. So the state still has the burden to show that this could be used in a deadly manner, and here it simply did not do that. And I would note there's another case in the third district called Webbington, where the court found that nunchucks and karate sticks were not deadly weapons per se. The court or the state had the burden of proving that they were used in a deadly manner or could be used. And here, this, like I said, this. It was unrebutted by the state that this machete was flimsy, about to fall off. There was no testimony to the contrary. The judge, and it's not clear that the judge understood the standard. There was no argument to that effect, no evidence to that effect. I would say, at the time of the machete incident, even in the light most favorable to the state, Johnson testified that he didn't waive this. He held it straight out. The case law is pretty clear that even if someone believes that someone has a knife and is going to assault them, there has to be more. There has to be accompanying gestures or accompanying threats. Johnson testified that there were no threats there. He didn't waive it. He's, affirmatively testified that he didn't waive it. So this isn't just an absence of evidence. He testified there's no waiving, there was no threats. This can't be an assault. It was separated from this initial threats. He crossed a highway. He was all the way across a highway whenever he was holding this machete. As to waiver, again, this is a sufficiency of the evidence claim. You can't waive sufficiency of the evidence. And here the state just didn't introduce the evidence necessary. So I would argue that can't be waived. The case cited by the defendant was, or the state was inapposite to this case. They were arguing over whether this was a category two weapon or not, whether it was classified over the classification, but the court actually went on to address the sufficiency of the evidence. And that would be all I have, unless the court has more questions for me. We would again ask for reversal on all three of these convictions.
Well, thank you, counsel. Justice Scholar, Justice Vaughn, do you have any final questions?
No questions.
I hate to be delaying things. Just so I'm clear on the record again, he was found guilty on three. There were six counts filed. He was found guilty on three counts. Two of the counts he was found guilty of involved the machete. One count he was found guilty of, count five, was a misdemeanor, but it was assault on public property. Had nothing to do with the machete. Is that accurate?
That would be accurate, Your Honor. When he was holding the machete, he was across the road and he was on the church's property.
He was found guilty of counts two, three, and five. Is that correct?
Let me look at the counts here briefly.
That's right, two, three, and five. And two was aggravated assault of a municipal employee by using the machete. Three was aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. And five was aggravated assault on public property.
That's correct, Your
Or maybe
Honor.
not aggravated assault, but assault, yeah, aggravated assault on public property. So, okay, thank you.
Yes, those are correct.
Thank you. And that did not involve the machete. That was just coming over and getting within 8 feet. Count
Yeah,
five.
let me look at this. I know that, and I want to be sure before I answer that because the allegations in the information were vastly different than what was actually the evidence at trial. So let me look at this indictment. If you can give me a moment, I apologize.
I'm looking at it, and count five
Oh.
says, he jumped off the tractor's operator, charged at Nathan Johnson on foot, causing Nathan Johnson to step backwards. So
Yes, so that
that
means.
appears to be the one where he crossed the street and came at him. The other two involved the machete, and he did not cross the street.
Well, and so that's not accurate as what the evidence came in. When he crossed the street, he never had the machete. Johnson
That's what
testified
I'm
to
saying.
this.
Five doesn't involve the machete. Five, the
Yeah.
aggravation is the public property. So he came onto the property.
Yeah, he came onto the public
Garage.
the city garage property, but there was no evidence as to his knowledge of that, but it is accurate that he did cross over to the public to the city garage
Okay, thank
across the
you.
highway.
Thank you. Well, thank you, counsel. Obviously, we'll take the matter under advisement. We'll issue an order in due course.